It's been a real privilege for me to be able to share this weekend. Thank you for those who've come and shared personally with me. And I want to make myself available before the end. So please, if you would like to come and talk personally, do take the opportunity before the end. And it's just a real privilege for me to be able to share. I remember vividly being a junior doctor at a number of CMF conferences. And I can remember some of those conferences did have a real impact on me. And I'm praying that by God's grace, this conference too will have an impact on a number of people here, and that you'll be able to see that God has been speaking to you as he's been speaking to me as I've been preparing these words. So I felt that 1 Corinthians 13, those wonderful words that we've been reading, should be my theme for this final talk, and with some reflections about the Greek word agape, because there's a real problem in English for us as we read the Bible. I don't think that people recognize quite what a problem it is, and that is that the word love has been so trampled, so debased, so distorted in our contemporary culture that we've lost the shock of what the Bible is actually talking about. You know, it's the big L. We talk about making love, which is just sex, and talk about love childs. Then we get this phrase, which I hate to be honest, but give me some love. Just give me some love, you know, which is just be nice to me. Say something nice. Whitney Houston singing about learning to love yourself is the greatest love of all. Yeah, what's that about? And then this idea that love is just a variety of feelings, states, and attitudes, interpersonal affection, pleasure. So the problem is that this word has been so devalued and trampled and manipulated and deformed until it means anything and nothing. And I think it's a real problem when we read the biblical text with modern eyes. So as we approach these familiar words, I want to suggest that we try to remove all those associations and try to ourselves with the church in Corinth, put ourselves with the church in Corinth as they read or heard these words read to them for the first time. So what we know is that it's very likely that Jesus actually didn't speak in Greek, Koine Greek, although he knew it. He actually spoke in Aramaic, which was just the common version of Hebrew, which was spoken at the time in Palestine. But the New Testament writers decided, rather than just transcribe Jesus' words literally in Aramaic, they decided to translate it into the common form of Greek that was around at the time, Koine Greek. For obvious reasons, because Koine Greek was like the English of the ancient world. It was the common language which most people knew. It was the language of commerce. It was the language generally used in the marketplace. So by translating Jesus' words into Greek, they made them accessible across the modern world, across the ancient world, sorry. And so they had to choose a Greek word to translate when Jesus used the Hebrew word for love. Which Greek word were they going to choose? I understand that at the time there were a number of common words that they could have chosen. There was the word eros, which meant sexual desire or passion, an internal force that drives a lover to extreme and irrational behavior. That's eros. There's storge, which meant a kind of familial love, the love of a mother or a father for a child. And there was philia, which just means friendship, having a sort of a general word for friendship. But interestingly, they didn't choose any of those words. They felt none of those words could capture what Jesus was talking about. And so they chose a little used word. It was a word that existed, but in fact was very little used in the Greek language. And it was the word agape. And it was a rather bland and neutral kind of word. And it seems that it was deliberate that the New Testament writers chose this word, agape, which was a bland and neutral word, so they could invest it with new meaning. So they freighted this neutral word, agape, with a whole new meaning, a meaning of a Christian love, which was completely different from eros and storge and all those other kinds of love. This was agape. And so when they took the Gospels and they wrote the Gospels, so for instance in John 12, where Jesus says, love one another, my command to you is to love. They said, in the Greek Testament, it says, Jesus says, agape one another. So they took this word agape and agapeo, which is the verb. And wherever Jesus talks about love, they translated agape. And lo and behold, in 1 Corinthians 13, here is the definition, the description of this special thing, agape. So whenever we see love, we've got to mentally translate it in our English translations into this particular unique Christian concept, agape. And trying to define agape is extremely difficult, but I was struck by one of this from a Greek lexicon that said, agape is called out of one's heart by the preciousness of the object loved. It is self-giving love. So the essence of agape is the preciousness of the one to whom we're responding, and out of agape we then give ourselves to the one. And the remarkable and wonderful thing is that what the New Testament teaches is that agape goes to the very heart of the Godhead. Agape is the way that the Father treats the Son. And agape is the way that the Son treats the Father. And agape is the way that the Father treats the Spirit. And the Spirit treats the Father. And the Spirit treats the Son. And the Son treats the Spirit. It's all agape. It is the givingness, the sacrificing love. Sacrificing agape is the very nature of God himself. So when we say God is agape, that's what it means. That the very heart of the divine relations, the triune God, is the instantiation of agape. And so what I want to get across is this idea that agape love is actually rather strange. It isn't this big L. It isn't this common word. This is a strange and wonderful and mysterious reality. It's based on deep respect for the value and the good of the other. So one way to think about it is the difference between pity love and respect love. There's an awful lot of pity love in the NHS. And the trouble with pity love is that it's very caring, it's very practical. When you pity someone, oh, you poor thing, you know, I'm here to help you. But the trouble with pity love, if you've ever been the recipient of pity love, you know that you feel demeaned. It actually makes you feel less than you are. To be pitied is the worst thing in the world. And so the contrast is agape is respect love. When we, apparently this was part of the original meaning of the original word agape, was to include this concept of respect. So isn't it fascinating that when the Bible teaches that God loves us, God treats us with agape, what it's actually saying is that God treats us with respect. God doesn't pity you. He doesn't say, oh, poor you, isn't it pathetic being you? No, something far more amazing. God actually respects you as a unique and wonderful human being made in his image, whom he loves and names and calls and longs to spend eternity with. Agape love is the respect love. It's self-giving love, love that gives itself utterly and without limits to the other. And also interestingly, agape love is entirely free love. It's not compelled by irresistible emotion and passion. No, it's freely chosen. We choose to love. That's why Jesus can say in John 15, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Now, if love was just an irresistible passion, some kind of chemistry, then it's meaningless to be told, commanded, that you must love. But actually, if agape is an action of the will, then it makes sense that we can choose to treat one another with agape, a matter of choice, a matter of the will. So it's not a natural, ordinary, sensible kind of love. It's an extreme kind of giving yourself for the other. And so as we go back to 1 Corinthians 13, we've got to read like this. Agape is patient. Agape is kind. Agape always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And of course, the nature of agape love is the actual nature of Christ. It's the character of Christ. As we read the chapter, what we're reading is a portrait of the life of Christ, a portrait of the way that Jesus behaved, full of agape. And this is the way I believe God calls us to practice medicine, with this strange, extreme, wonderful kind of self-giving, self-sacrificial behavior. So that's the first thing. The agape love is strange and wonderful and reflects the character of Jesus, but it's the way that God calls us to practice medicine. Second, agape involves being emotionally involved. It's not just a cognitive, intellectual thing. I love the passage in Luke chapter 7 where Jesus and his disciples are just having a random encounter. It's one of the very interesting things. It happens time and time again in the Gospels that the Gospel writers emphasize that Jesus' action was not something that was carefully programmed and planned. Jesus' love and compassion responds to random events. It's the random events that someone happens to come up. As he's walking, he happens to meet someone. Time and time again, it's the random events of life that calls forth Jesus' compassion. And it's going to be true for us too. It's in the random events, quotes, of our daily clinical work, of those random meetings we have in the A&E department, on the ward, in the doctor's mess. Those chance encounters is where the opportunities for agape are going to be. And agape involves emotional involvement, because in this passage where Luke, the physician, is describing what's happened to Jesus, that Jesus is walking along and he sees this pathetic little funeral procession. There's just people who are weeping. There's a widow. And now she's burying her only son. So, you know, Luke, he just paints the portrait. Here's, she's lost her husband, and now she's lost her only son. And all the sort of tragedy, the loss, the hopelessness, and also the danger, because in the ancient Palestine society, it was either your husband or your father or your son who would protect you as a widow. You were wide open to abuse. And she was now in this destitute state. And the extraordinary thing is that Luke then says, Jesus' heart went out to her. That's what the English translation is. But that's a very sanitized translation, because the Greek Luke chose to use a medical word. And the medical word is splanchnidzomai. And you will probably recognize splanchnic, meaning of the bowels. And what splanchnidzomai means is that Jesus' bowels were moved in emotion. Can you believe it? If you were writing the gospel, suppose you were writing a gospel about how Jesus was the Son of God, do you think you would talk about his bowels being moved? And yet, that word, splanchnidzomai, occurs time and time again in the Gospels. Why? Answer, because what the apostles saw, the disciples, is that Jesus was emotionally involved, that he was gutted, to use a more modern expression. And he was gutted by the loss of a completely anonymous little widow, a stranger. And yet here is Jesus being emotionally involved. In fact, time and time again, they emphasize that. They use another word, which is talking equivalent, apparently, of waters being deeply stirred up. It says Jesus was deeply moved. Another word is where it's used of a horse snorting in anger. So Jesus was deeply emotionally involved with the people he was trying to care for. And it's interesting that the gospel writer's stressing this reality of the incarnation, that Jesus is a human being responding humanly. Because, of course, in the Greek vision, God was unable to suffer. Suffering was part of an inferior human existence, and God was beyond that, remote and passionless. But the God revealed in the face of Jesus Christ is a God who suffers, a God who enters into human suffering, a God who cares. And that is really a visual description of empathy, of entering into the emotion of the other, of feeling with the other. And I think if we are followers of Jesus, I believe we're called to be emotionally engaged with our patients as Jesus was involved. Now, this isn't very much part of sort of standard medical training, isn't it? It tends to be we are encouraged to be emotionally detached, to be cool, to be disinterested, to be quietly, slightly cynical, to hold ourselves back. Don't get involved. But I genuinely believe if we were trying to follow and demonstrate the agape of Christ, that is not an option for us. We are called to be emotionally involved. Even though that's going to be painful. It means opening ourselves to the pain that's around us, because just like Jesus, we're surrounded by people who are hurting. And the natural response is to withdraw, to protect ourselves. I'm sure many professionals have this cool clinical attitude because it's a kind of self-protection. It's because they don't want to expose themselves to the pain. It's a defense mechanism. But the problem is that that cool clinical image alienates us from those we're aiming to help. Empathy, the way of Christ. You see, the problem with the cool professional is it sort of says, well, you're the patient, you're in trouble, but I'm different. I'm a professional. I'm here to help. I know a lot. I'm going to help you, but I'm different from you. What empathy says, you are the same, you and I. We are the same. I'm a human being like you. And I'm here to care for you and to walk this road with you and to share the pain. So I remember once a mother who'd gone through the terrible experience of delivering a stillborn baby in hospital. And she told me years later that it still hurt her that nobody in the hospital had bothered to say that they were sorry. Perhaps the staff were so busy being professional that they had no time to show that they cared. And of course, there's a tension here. Because of our human weakness, there must be limits to the extent of our emotional involvement. For me, as a neonatologist, I was dealing a lot with real tragedy, with baby brain damage, baby death, and so on. And what I found is that when I became a parent myself, and our children were actually born in the same hospital at UCH, my job became suddenly much more emotionally harrowing, because now I was able to empathize at a much deeper level than I was able before. And I think that made it harder, but actually it made me a better doctor. It made me able to express empathy. And I was quite touched just recently. I got a message on my website from a lady who said, you won't remember me, but 20 years ago, you cared for my child. And I remember how you wept with me when you told me that the baby had brain damage. And I still remember that 20 years later. And I was touched by that because it just shows when we do express humanity and when we do express empathy, people remember, they notice. It's not what you expect from a professional. You expect a professional to be competent. You don't expect a professional to care. And when we do care, people notice. This is agape, and it's different. But of course, we have to, at the same time, protect ourselves. We must find a balance between clinical involvement, emotional involvement, and when it becomes too much, when we're taking too much on ourselves. And I think when I look back on myself, I probably lost that balance. And that was ultimately one of the big things that led to my psychiatric breakdown. I was, after my breakdown, I was talking to a professional psychotherapist, and I explained to him the kind of pressures I'd been under, the kind of counseling I was doing, supporting parents and so on. And he said, you know, if we'd put a psychotherapist into the neonatal unit and they were doing the same job, we would have made sure, one, they had weekly supervision with an external person, and two, after 18 months, we would have rotated them out into some less stressful area for recovery before rotating them back in. And yet I had been carrying on like this week after week, month after month, year after year, with no supervision and no chance of rotating out. And when I look back, I think, well, that was just stupid. I mean, that just wasn't very clever, very intelligent to put yourself in that position. So we do have to find this balance. We do have to find a way of finding support mechanisms for ourselves. If we're doing the work of caring, but the work of being emotionally involved, then the question is, how are you going to find the support mechanisms that are going to support you? So just very briefly, I think I can think at least four different support mechanisms that we should be thinking of. And the first is our friends. You know, Christian friendship is an incredibly important part of walking the Christian life. So much so that it's almost impossible to walk as a Christian unless you have strong Christian friends. And yet friendship in our culture has been heavily devalued. Sex is everything. Asexual friendship is just nothing, meaningless. The only really valuable things are... is that? It might be there. It's not happy. Okay. Don't touch anything. So first of all is friendship. So can I say to you, now is the time for you to be building really strong friendships. One of the wonderful things is 40 years later, some of the best and most strong and meaningful friendships in my life are friendships I made as medical school and as a junior doctor. Those friendships last for life. They can do. And they become a vital support mechanism, but they need investing in. So can I ask you one practical point? Think about a small number of friendships which are really important to you and that could be support for you as you go through your clinical career, and invest in those friendships. Go out of your way to nurture those friendships, because friends are one of the primary ways that God reaches out to us. There's a beautiful thing that Bernard of Clairvaux, a writer of the medieval period, said, and he said this: Christ himself kisses us in the love of our friends. Christ himself kisses us in the love of our friends. And that's true for me. I have felt time and time again the love of Christ himself as my friends have reached out to me. So friendship. Second, professional colleagues. I think that we need to develop a culture of being more open with our professional colleagues, of sharing some of the emotional stresses and strains, sometimes of taking the initiative to talk about our own issues and struggles. Often we're very frightened to do that. We think that if we're going to talk about our own emotional stuff, other people will despise us or think we're unprofessional or whatever. But I think we need to push back against that bad medical culture and have a better medical culture of openness. Third, the Christian community. Junior doctors often find that their links with the local church are weakened or broken because of weekend duties and frequent moves. Yet the practical support of our Christian sisters and brothers in a local church community makes a vital difference. So even if you can't get to church every Sunday, we need to maintain and nourish our links with the local church. And that means explaining the kind of pressures we're under and the needs for prayer and friendship and support. And then finally, our own personal life with Christ. In Peter, it says 1 Peter chapter 5, cast all your anxieties on him, for he cares for you. So Jesus found the emotional resources for his ministry in the intimacy of his relationship with his Father. And God longs to care for us as we care for our patients. As we learn to practice the presence of Christ day by day, we will discover new emotional and spiritual resources for our work. So this wonderful verse in Ephesians says that we are God's handiwork, and the literal Greek is poema, you're God's poem, created in Christ Jesus for good works which God prepared in advance for us to do. And I believe, as practicing clinicians, we should take this verse as absolutely literally true, because I believe it is literally true. I don't know how it works, but basically, when you go into the clinic or the ward round or the A&E department, believe it or not, the God of eternity has prepared for you beforehand good works, good things to do. They're all there waiting for you. You don't need to engineer anything. You don't need to make it happen. You just need the eyes to see this is an opportunity. This is something that God has given to you, this chance event. And so something I learnt and tried to do every day, I failed many, many times, but in my clinical career, as I tried to prepare myself before I hit the hospital, before I hit the neonatal unit, to say, Lord, I want to be your person today, and I want to have my eyes open to what you are doing in the neonatal unit, to what you are doing in my patients. Help me to see what you're up to. And when I get a chance to speak, help me not to blow it. And what I realized was that time and time again, chance things would happen. And people would just happen to say, you know, would raise questions. And so often that it came like a little sign, opportunity, opportunity. So I stopped praying for opportunities because it was obvious there were too many opportunities. And I started to pray, God, help me not to blow it. I mean, I can tell this is an opportunity, but what do I say? So, but actually, you know, if you can get that in the right attitude, then every day becomes an adventure. Every day becomes an exciting adventure of what on earth is God up to and how can I learn to be there. And one of the things I also found is that you can actually pray and talk at the same time. You can learn to pray inside as you are having this conversation. Lord, give me wisdom, help me to know what to say. Perhaps I should say, should I not say this? You know, if you want me to say something, help set the conversation to go in that way. So I'm internally praying while at the same time I'm speaking. So my testimony is, by God's grace, time and time again through my work as a neonatologist, I saw these opportunities coming, chances of speaking about Christ. I saw glimpses of the way that the God of the universe was able to use even my limited and rather pathetic ministry in the lives of my patients and my colleagues. And I love this concept of practicing the presence of Christ. The phrase was created by Brother Lawrence, who was a lowly kitchen servant in a monastery in Paris over 300 years ago. He wasn't even a proper monk. His job was washing the pots and pans. But Brother Lawrence experienced the joy of living each day, moment by moment, in the presence of Christ. And every tiny event of his life, he turned into prayer. And at the end of his life, a collection of his thoughts was put together, and it became a classic called Practicing the Presence of Christ. You can still get it on the internet, and I recommend it. It's worth reading. And so that's the spiritual discipline we need to learn, is to bring conscious awareness of Christ into every activity of our working lives, in the hospital or the clinic. It's not easy, and it's a lifetime's goal. And many, many times I felt I failed, and I would get to the end of the day and I'd suddenly think I hadn't thought about Jesus or anything eternal. The whole blooming day, I've been so focusing just on what I've been doing. But actually, there were other days where it was like the presence of Christ was like a fragrance, a background fragrance throughout that day, that I knew he was there with me. So we all know we get caught up in the rush of our lives and we can lose completely the sense of our Christian calling. So how can we start to practice the presence of Christ? Well, I've learned it all starts at the beginning of the day. You have to prepare yourself before you hit the hospital. By the time you've actually hit the hospital, it's too late. You get just swept into all the demands and the to-do lists and everything going on. So it's all about preparing yourself before you hit the hospital, even only 5 or 10 minutes. We live about 8 minutes from the underground station, and I've used those 8 minutes of walking to the underground station. I tried to make it a discipline that I would pray for the coming day and prepare myself. And then through our working day, we need to look for brief opportunities for silent prayer, for reminders of the spiritual world. One writer suggested that these brief times were like regular oases in the desert. So where might you find an oasis in your working life? It might be when we're walking down a corridor from one place in the hospital to the next, or when we're waiting for a lift. It might be in the clinic, in the brief pause when the next patient comes in. I tried to make it a discipline that after, in the outpatient department, after one patient or their family went out, I would just take a few seconds to pray for them and to pray for the next one before then calling the next one in. I tried to make a discipline when I was carrying a bunch of notes that I would try to pray for the people and the patients in the notes, trying to bring Christ into the daily experience of our working lives. When I was a junior doctor on the neonatal unit, a lot of the time we used to have to do these blood gas machines. You had to take a sample from the baby, you went into the little lab and you squirted the blood gas sample through, and then you had to wait until the sample came out. So I tried to make it a discipline. While I was waiting for the result, I would pray for the baby and pray for the families, and pray for the medical team who are caring for that patient. So by practicing this kind of discipline, we can find brief oases in our working day. We can experience the reality of Christ's presence. And we must remember that Christ meets us not just in our prayers, but also in our patience. So remember the parable of the sheep and the goats, and that Jesus says, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And Mother Teresa, working with the dying in the slums of Calcutta, taught her sisters that they must treat everyone they cared for, the leprosy victim, the abandoned child with AIDS, the prostitute, as though they were tending the wounds of Christ. For it was Jesus who was there. She said, here on the streets, in the unwanted children, in the broken body of the leper, in the dying beggar, we see Christ. We touch him and we care for him. Inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And that example really affected me deeply as a pediatrician. Because Jesus was a baby, then all babies are special. So I came to realize that I was called to treat this tiny little body, struggling for life, covered in infusion tubes, attached to the life support machinery, with the same tenderness and with the same respect that Mary and Joseph would have treated their little bundle. How would they have treated the baby Jesus? How do you think Mary handled him? How did you think she changed his nappy? Surely it was more than just... There would be a kind of gentleness and a kind of respect. Agape love, respect love. And that's the way we're called to treat even the most pathetic of our patients. We're called to see Christ in our patients. And I was quite touched when I know that one of my consultant colleagues, a junior consultant colleague, said, you know, I've never forgotten from the way you cared, you treated those babies, the way you examined them and handled them. That's the way I want to handle babies. So people notice. They notice the way we're behaving. They notice our attitudes. And that's one of the way we can influence others. So it's true that God saw you and knew you and chose you before the foundation of the world. And he wrote for you a unique part in the great drama of the universe. So on the one hand, God's grace is sovereign and powerful. But you know, we have a genuine choice. And so we can choose whether or not we want to play our part in the great drama. So fourthly, agape love means freely choosing to give yourself, choosing to play your part in the great drama. And Leslie Newbegin said these beautiful words: "You have to indwell the story of the Bible as the true story of the whole world." In other words, what we're called to do is not just read the story of the Bible, we're called to indwell it. You're called to realize you're part of the same story. You're part of the same drama. You're written in there. You have a part to play. A bit. We're bit players in the great drama. But you know, we're not coerced into obedience by pure spiritual power. That's not the way that God works. We all know that a forced marriage is not a marriage at all. To put it crudely, we all understand there is an absolute difference between rape and genuine, consensual, loving sex. They're not the same thing. And the heart of all genuine agape relationships is freedom and consent. And the wonderful thing is that God loves freedom and consent. That is the nature of agape. The Father is not compelled to love the Son. He chooses to love the Son. The Son chooses to love the Father freely, and we are choose whether or not to play our part. It's as though God is saying, your Heavenly Father and your Heavenly Bridegroom are saying to you, do you really want to do this? Do you really want to give yourself in agape love to me? Do you want to play the part that I've written for you? And the response we give to that question is not play acting. It's deadly serious. We have a genuine choice. I believe you can say yes or no. For instance, I think that Mary, the mother of Jesus, had a genuine choice. You know, when the angel comes to her and tells her she's highly favored and that she's going to bear a son, I think Mary could have taken a deep breath and said, well, it's a fantastic privilege and I feel deeply honored, but actually you've got the wrong person. I can't do this. In which case, the angel would have gone away and found another virgin for the house of David. And maybe we would all be celebrating Tabitha, the mother of the Lord. But instead, Mary takes a deep breath and she says, I am the bondslave of the Lord. Let it be to me as you have said. In other words, I say yes. I give my consent. That's all she has to do. She hasn't got to make it happen. She's just got to say yes. She's just got to give her consent. Agape love may lead us to costly sacrifice. And in this beautiful passage in John 12, you know the story, Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she pours it on Jesus' feet and wipes his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. This incident in John's Gospel, John emphasizes that this incident happens only a matter of days before Jesus is crucified at the time of the Passover. So Mary takes something that is very precious to her, a treasured and incredibly valuable possession. It was probably the most precious thing she had in her possession. A vase with half a litre of expensive perfume. It was a huge quantity. It's probably equivalent to a year's wages, thousands of pounds in modern money. And she stoops down to the feet of Jesus and she pours the precious ointment on his feet. And such is the quantity of the perfume that the whole house is filled with the fragrance. And then in a shocking and intimate act, she lets her hair down, stoops down to his feet, and tenderly wipes his feet with her hair. It's a strange and a wonderful scene of intimate tenderness. It's a sensual and scandalous act, actually. Respectable Jewish women did not let down their hair in male company. This was something for the intimacy and privacy of the bedroom. And yet here is Mary, out of loving sacrifice, washing the feet of Jesus. Mary is demonstrating agape love, concern for Christ by this act which encompasses humility and self-abasement, tenderness and extravagant sacrifice for the person of Jesus. And then Judas reacts, why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? And his reaction is that of the sensible, pragmatic, evidence-based moralist. In fact, if evidence-based medicine existed in first century Palestine, Judas Iscariot would have been a supporter. Because the ointment was worth nearly a year's wages, thousands of pounds. But Jesus understands Mary's heart, and he defends her. Leave her alone. This perfume was for the day of my burial. Many commentators think that Jesus knew that in reality she was anointing his body for burial. And they've pointed out that because of the intense fragrance and the quantity of the perfume, the smell, the fragrance would still have been present when Jesus was crucified 6 days later. In other words, as Jesus hung on the cross, what was he smelling? He was smelling the fragrance of her love, even in his darkest hour. Mary's sacrificial love was anointing his body. And you know, Christian carers have often been called to self-sacrificial love. When I was a medical student at St. Thomas's Hospital, there was this great guy, president of the CU, Keith Knox. God had called him to be a missionary. He was going to go to Uganda. He trained. He got the necessary clinical experience. Then we had this great farewell service at St. Thomas's, and the CU were there, and we were all praising, and Keith Knox went off to Uganda. And literally within days of arriving, he was involved in a terrible road accident and was killed. And just a few weeks later, we had this celebration service again at St. Thomas's Hospital, thanksgiving for the life of Keith Knox. And I still remember the funeral, the person who gave the talk based it around this text about Mary. And he used this phrase, why this waste? Why this waste of a life? And you know what the answer was? So that the house would be filled with the fragrance of love. And it was true. And you know, Christian doctors time and time again have been called to self-sacrificial love and sometimes to give their lives. In times of plague, they've given their lives caring for leprosy sufferers. The medical missionaries in the 19th century, you know, medical missionaries that were called out to go to Africa to serve Christ, and they used to go knowing what was waiting for them. It is said that the average life expectancy for medical missionaries traveling from the West to Africa was literally months, that they were going to die of tropical diseases, malaria and other things, and they knew it was happening, and yet they still kept coming. In fact, apparently, as they went out on the ships to Africa, they took their coffins with them. And yet they kept coming out of self-sacrificial love. And up into the modern day, you know, in the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone, a whole number of Christian doctors and nurses and health professionals chose voluntarily to risk their lives to care for their patients. They knew that their protective equipment was useless. They knew that they were exposing themselves to massive risks, and some of them died. But they did it out of agape love. And, you know, it's perfectly possible that in your lifetime there will be some other great medical crisis which will mean that medical people will be called yet again to risk their lives in order to serve their patients. If there's some kind of pandemic infection comes across the world, it happened with SARS, where there were all kinds of questions about whether or not the health professionals could be protected and who was going to care for the patients and so on. So you never know, I never know, when we might be confronted with the same kind of questions that have challenged health professionals before. So Christian medicine may call us to pay a very high price. And notice that Mary's act of sacrifice was entirely voluntarily and uncompelled. So that's my question to you and to me. What is the most precious, the most costly closed container in our life? And are we prepared to sacrifice it and pour it out at the feet of Jesus out of generous and costly love? Our natural tendency is to grasp, to hold on to the things that are most precious. But the way of fruitfulness is to voluntarily choose to open your hand and give it to God and release the precious things we hold so tightly. And remember the words of Jesus in John's Gospel, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And I was very moved by the words of Jim Elliot, who was a modern missionary martyr. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. I'm very conscious that much of this is theory. I continue to struggle with this, just as we all do, to live in the reality. But I know in the core of my being, it's the way of fruitfulness. It's the way of effectiveness. And actually, paradoxically, it's the way of joy. Because time and time again, Christian history bears witness to the fact that as Christians give themselves in sacrifice, they find joy. It says in Hebrews that Jesus gave his life for the joy that was set before him. He endured the cross and despised the shame. And I'm sure that Mary did not begrudge the sacrifice of that perfume. I'm sure her eyes were filled with tears of love and tears of joy. This is what the perfume was for, to anoint the body of her Lord for death. There could be no higher calling. So back to 1 Corinthians 13 and this final wonderful phrase. Agape love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Agape never fails. Now, you know, from a human perspective, it seems that agape frequently does fail. And certainly in my own clinical experience, you pour out your love on a patient, on a family, and it seems like it's just thrown in your face. Or the patient staggers on for months and then eventually dies. And you think, all that love, all that caring, all that compassion, where did it go? Was it just a waste? Was it just destroyed and lost? Futile? You know, the theologians say that agape is what they call an eschatological virtue. What that means is it points towards the future time. Whenever we practice agape, we are pointing towards the future. And we are saying, this is not the end of the story. The world is going to hear more about Jesus. And love never fails. So if we go back to 1 Corinthians 13, if you've got it there, it says in verse 12, for now we see only a reflection in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now we know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and agape. But the greatest of these is agape. So in the future age, in the new heaven and the new earth, there will be no need for prophecies, no need for tongues, there'll be no need for preachers and theological teaching, but all those small and forgotten acts of sacrifice, of compassion, of faithfulness, of caring, they will all be there. Nothing will be lost, nothing is forgotten, nothing is wasted. Love never fails. Let's have just a moment of silence and we reflect on that.